This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Pete's Coffee and Tea, celebrating the season with Holiday Blend Coffee and Holiday Breakfast Blend Tea at Pete's retail stores or on the web at Pete's.com. This KABU program has been made possible in part by KABU Foundation members and a grant from Awakened Media, presenting The Real Dirt on Farmer John, a film about the true story of maverick farmer John Peterson's hero's journey of life, love, death, and sweet potatoes. Opens Wednesday, February 1st at Cinema 21. Information at therealdirt.net.
Our allies in the fight for affordable health care.
I'm Andy Seaton, KABU News.
For KBOO in Portland, I'm Julie Sabatier.
KABU's Afifa Ahmed Shafi reports.
I'm Stephanie Potter, KABU News.
KABU's Eduardo de Landeros Tiere has more.
I'm Annalisa Hummel.
And I'm Liam Delta.
This is Maddie Bowden.
I'm Alex Collins, KABU News.
I'm Michael Newman, KABU News.
I'm Courtney Dillard, KABU News.
Coming up on the KABU Evening News, Coretta Scott King dies at the age of 78.
New rules for lobbyists in the wake of the Abramoff scandal.
The last Rajanish avoids prison.
And in the human cost of occupation in Iraq. As of today, there have been 2,243 officially acknowledged deaths of American soldiers, with as many as 48,000 others wounded. IraqBodyCount.org reports 31,000 civilians have been reported killed by military intervention in Iraq. Last year, the medical journal The Lancet reported as many as 194,000 civilian casualties, not counting Fallujah since the invasion.
Good evening. This is the KABU Evening News for Tuesday, January 31st, 2006. I'm Kate Welch.
And I'm Doug Guidi. A winter storm warning remains in effect until 10 a.m. tomorrow, the National Weather Service in Portland announced today. Snow will increase over the Cascades this afternoon, becoming heavy at times tonight. The snow will taper off to snow showers tomorrow morning. Accumulations of 1 to 2 feet are likely, with higher amounts above 4,500 feet. In addition to snow in the mountains, a high wind warning is in effect until 10 p.m. tonight. Winds have begun to increase along the coast as a strong Pacific front approaches. At 11 a.m. today, the wind speed at Clatsop Spit was 35 miles per hour, gusting to 48 miles per hour. The front will move onto the north and central Oregon coast tonight, with gusts up to 60 miles per hour possible north and 70 miles per hour possible on the central coast.
Two Oregon lawmakers said that they will hold hearings on the recent theft of 365,000 patients' records from Providence Health System, hoping to revive privacy protection legislation. Senator Floyd Prusansky, a Eugene Democrat who heads the Senate's Committee on Consumer Protection, said he would draft legislation that would more strictly regulate businesses that handle sensitive information and provide new protections for consumers. Oregon has no law requiring companies to report privacy lapses, unlike California, Washington, and at least 21 other states. Last year, a security breach bill authorized by Prusansky failed to gain enough support to reach the Senate floor. The December 31st theft involved a computer case stuffed with backup disks and tapes containing names, addresses, social security numbers, and medical information from patients receiving home services, personal information on 1,500 current and former employees of the division were also stolen. According to the Attorney General's office, as of Monday, no cases of identity theft have been linked to the stolen records.
Oregon kids are getting fatter, and it's becoming a huge health problem for them and for the state. That according to a new report released today by Children First for Oregon. KABU's Ross Egan reports.
Nearly one in four Oregon high school students is seriously overweight or at risk for obesity. That's an epidemic threatening the health of the entire state, according to a report released today, Tuesday, by Children First for Oregon. Kathy Kaufman with Children First says obesity is more than just being overweight. It also leads to lifelong diseases like diabetes,
heart disease, and asthma.
Because of childhood obesity, this generation is likely to be the first to be less healthy and to have a shorter life expectancy than their parents.
Kaufman says that schools are an important front in the battle against obesity. A recommitment to physical health and nutritional education would help.
We also want schools to stop selling soda and junk food to kids through vending machines. A lot of schools are doing this as a way to make money. We feel like schools are responding to budget cuts by selling the health of their students.
She also says that obesity puts a lot of pressure on an already faltering healthcare system. She says estimates show $781 million was spent on health needs due to obesity in Oregon between 1998 and 2000. Content was provided by the Oregon News Service. I'm Ross Egan for KBOO News.
Republican Representative Susan Morgan of Myrtle Creek has announced her plans to seek a fifth term in the Oregon House of Representatives. District 2 includes a large portion of Douglas County and smaller portions of Josephine and Jackson counties. During the 2005 session, Morgan was vice chair of the Joint Ways and Means Committee and vice chair of the House Budget Committee. In addition to the state budget, Morgan has built a strong record on natural resource, land use, and educational issues.
State Senator Vicki Walker of Eugene will announce her decision about running for public office tomorrow. Walker is considering a challenge to Governor Kulongoski in the Democratic primary for governor, or she may seek re-election to the state Senate against Jim Torrey, the former Republican mayor of Eugene. But she told the Eugene Register-Guard that she will either run for governor, run for her state Senate seat, or sit out the election altogether and focus on her court reporting business. At this time, the only Democrat challenger, Kulongoski, is Lane County Commissioner Peter Sorensen.
A disciple of the Indian guru Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh has been sentenced to 5 years probation for conspiring to kill a U.S. attorney more than 20 years ago. 60-year-old Catherine Stork cried in the federal courthouse yesterday. Stork pleaded guilty last fall, joining six other followers who had earlier done the same. The others were sentenced to prison for 2 to 5 years. Stork was a member of a commune that operated on a ranch in the central Oregon town of Antelope in the 80s. Last year, Stork voluntarily returned to Portland to face the federal charges in order to be free to travel to Australia to visit her dying son. Stork could have been sentenced to life in prison.
Governor Gregoire has signed the Gay Civil Rights Bill into law. It would take effect this spring unless Tim Iman can collect 112,000 signatures by June 7th to force a referendum vote. The measure adds sexual orientation to a state law that bans discrimination in housing, employment, insurance, and credit. It makes Washington the 17th state to pass laws extending civil rights protections to gays and lesbians. Iman filed two ballot measures yesterday to put the issue in the hands of voters. A referendum would vote down the new law. He also filed an initiative that would prohibit state government from requiring preferential treatment based on sexual orientation. The initiative requires twice as many signatures as a referendum, nearly 225,000 to make the fall ballot.
Governor Schwarzenegger's favorite line of late is, "I say build it." He's talking about his $222 billion strategic growth plan, which is chock full of funding for new roads, levees, schools, and jails. But in order to build just about anything in the state, projects need to go through the environmental review process set out in the California Environmental Quality Act, known as CEQA. Republicans in the legislatures say they plan to introduce legislation that would make changes to California's landmark environmental law. From KPCC, Tamara Keith reports.
CEQA was created in 1971. It requires all projects that need some sort of government approval to go through an environmental review. If there are environmental impacts, further studies are required, and sometimes mitigation, like a plan to fix the damage or a trade-off to protect one area but let the project go ahead. This whole process can be extremely expensive and time-consuming, says Senate Minority Leader and Irvine Republican Dick Ackerman. He says that if the state is going to be spending billions of dollars to improve infrastructure, he'd like to see as much money as possible go to the actual construction costs.
We want to cut down the cost of building that project, building that levee or whatever it is, and get more dollars into that project sooner.
He and his GOP colleagues see the California Environmental Quality Act as a major obstacle to quick, cheap construction. His favorite example is levees.
Prior to CEQA, the cost of maintaining and repairing a levee was like $200 or $300 a lineal foot. Now it ranges from $5,000 to $10,000 a foot. And this has nothing to do with repairing that thing. It has more to do with how you're going to treat the kangaroo rats or something else that you might find when you're doing it.
Kangaroo rats are little critters native to California that enjoy a protected status and have been the subject of many a CEQA dispute. Senator Ackerman says that if Republicans are going to sign on to the governor's strategic growth plan, some kind of CEQA reform is going to have to happen.
The levee has been there, so if you decide to repair the levee, you shouldn't have to have another environmental impact report to repair the levee. Under the current laws, you do. If you have a three-lane freeway and you want to add a lane, you have to have an environmental impact report. Probably not necessary. So a lot of those areas where there's no rationale or no reasonable reason to incur that cost, we're going to exempt it so you don't have to do it.
They don't want to tweak the edges. They want to get rid of it. They've wanted to get rid of it for the 35 years it's been in existence.
Phil Alio is state director of the Sierra Club. He disputes the whole idea that CEQA adds expense. He says in the long run, a more deliberative process for infrastructure improvements will save taxpayers money.
It's a more efficient process in the long run by doing the proper siting and the proper mitigation of potential negative impacts on rivers, our air, or neighbors to the project. So that's why CEQA is a step we just can't afford to skip.
Natural Resources Defense Council attorney Joel Reynolds points to a recent example where he says CEQA made a difference, a giant planned warehouse development in downtown L.A. The project was approved without an environmental impact report. Environmentalists sued, saying the project would have a negative impact on the neighborhood. They negotiated with the developer, and the land is now a state park.
That project will literally transform not just the site itself, but over the next decade or so, the surrounding community in a way that will enhance the quality of life for the residents and for all of us here in Los Angeles. That's a direct result of the protections that CEQA provides.
The environmental community is gearing up to defend CEQA from legislation expected to be introduced in the coming days. GOP leaders say their proposal is still taking shape, but it won't be a total overhaul of CEQA. Instead, the legislation will likely include exemptions from CEQA for certain projects and language limiting the amount of time for an environmental review. For the California Report, I'm Tamara Keith in Sacramento.
A dog owners advocacy group asked the U.S. Department of Justice to sue Contra Costa County over a new law that prohibits felons from owning aggressive dogs but does not include an exception for guide dogs. The Coalition for Human Advocates for Canines and Owners is accusing the county of violating the rights of disabled people by failing to include an exemption for service animals. The county ordinance, which was approved unanimously in November, also bars convicted felons from keeping dogs that weigh more than 20 pounds.
Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio news and independent native news following our newscast. Then at 6, hear something special. And at 7, Clemmy's Grooves. Tonight's weather, rain, breezy, mixed rain and snow above 500 feet early. Lows 40 to 45. South wind 20 to 25 miles per hour with gusts to 40 miles per hour. Tomorrow, showers likely in the morning, then rain in the afternoon. Highs around 50, southwest wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News, Portland, Corvallis, Vancouver, and Hood River.
It's a bleak morning for me and for many people, said poet Maya Angelou. And yet it's a great morning because we have a chance to look at her and see what she did and who she was. She was ours. I mean African Americans and white Americans and Asians, Spanish speaking. She belonged to us. And that's a great thing. During the most tumultuous days of the American Civil Rights Movement, Coretta Scott King stood arm to arm with her husband using nonviolent direct action in the struggle for justice. Coretta Scott King was also with her husband in the finest hours. She was at his side as he received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1964, and she marched at his side from Selma to Montgomery for the triumphal climax to the drive for a voting rights law. Days after Martin's death in 1968, she flew to Memphis with three of her children to lead thousands marching in honor of her slain husband and to plead for his cause. I think you rise to the occasion in a crisis, she once said. I think the Lord gives you strength when you need it. God was using us, and now he's using me too.
Former House members who work as lobbyists will no longer be able to sweat for votes in the House gym under a rule change the House is expected to approve Wednesday. The new rule, which would also end the tradition of former members lobbying on the House floor, is the first of several actions lawmakers are likely to take in the coming weeks to clean up their tarnished image in the wake of the Jack Abramoff lobbying scandal. On Wednesday, a House committee is to consider proposals to deny federal retirement benefits to officials convicted of crimes such as bribery and fraud. And House Rules Committee David Dreher, Republican of California, is set to unveil a GOP package of lobbying ethics changes aimed at ending or restricting gift-giving and trips arranged by lobbyists or their clients. The changes on access to the gym and the chamber, Dreher said at a meeting of his panel Tuesday, are the first step toward our reform package.
A judge approved a settlement of up to $85 million Tuesday between sexual abuse victims and the Roman Catholic Diocese of Covington, one of the largest deals the church has reached with U.S. parishioners who were molested by clergy. The settlement covers 361 victims who claimed they were abused over a period of 50 years by priests in a diocese that was once included 57 counties across a large swath of Kentucky. Judge John Potter said a desire by the Covington Diocese to make reparations to the victims contributed to the settlement. Contrary to what might be the case in other dioceses, the court believes that this professed desire is genuine and played a significant role in the diocese's decision. That's what Potter wrote in his 15-page ruling. The Covington settlement may equal a 2003 Boston Archdiocese payout to 552 people, but is less than a Diocese of Orange, California agreement in 2004 to pay $100 million to resolve about 90 abuse claims.
The current time is 5:19, and now daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Oh, hallelujah! The bonuses are in! Manna from heaven is showering down upon you. You are a Wall Street broker, aren't you? These few financial elites are the lucky devils who have recently been blessed with $21.5 billion in bonuses dispensed by Citigroup, Goldman Sachs, and other giants that twist our economy to their advantage. Even while the wages of working stiffs did not even keep up with inflation in 2005, these high-flying speculators enjoyed nearly a 50% increase in revenues, producing record profits. So they are now splitting the loot. The honcho of Goldman Sachs, for example, pulled in $38 million. The CEO of Lehman Brothers took $14.9 million, and the top dog at Morgan Stanley had to settle for $11.5 million. But after all, he only worked for 6 months last year. In fairness, I should note that their good fortunes are trickling down to those below, though certainly not to those as low down as you and me. But the sellers of multimillion-dollar estates, rare art, luxury imported cars, and private jets are in high cotton as the Wall Streeters rush to spend their bonanza. For example, Gotham Dream Cars in Manhattan will sell you a Lamborghini Gallardo for only $195,000. If you're a younger bonus baby on Wall Street who can't quite afford to buy this exotic vehicle, hey, Dream Cars will let you rent it for only $1,350 a day. It's the perfect way for people to celebrate without going overboard, says the president of Dream Cars. How egalitarian is that? Also, super luxury Manhattan apartments starting at $10 million are said to be a particularly hot market this year. As a broker for such properties puts it, we love Wall Street bonuses. This is Jim Hightower saying, remember, Bush and Company say that these financial hucksters are the very people who should take over our Social Security program. Support for this program comes from the Progressive Magazine, featuring columnists Miley Ivins, Howard Zinn, and Barbara Ehrenreich, with features and information available at progressive.org.
The Supreme Court recently ruled that the names of the prisoners at the Gitmo prison must be released. Most of these prisoners have been in prison for years without being brought before a court of law. Thus, their very identity is unknown. Recently, the Kabul prison, Pulisharki, has been designated as a probable new prison for the Afghani prisoners. Pulisharki, a huge prison complex built in the 1970s on the outskirts of Kabul, it is used to house common criminals as well as Al-Qaeda or Taliban-linked militants. Correspondents say the vast and rundown jail is notorious for the disappearance and torture of thousands of Afghans during the communist era. Afghan authorities say they are questioning 10 police guards arrested after the recent escape of Taliban prisoners in the capital, Kabul. 7 Taliban prisoners escaped from the country's main high-security Pulisharki prison, Director Abdul Salam Bakashi said. This is the second high-profile jail escape by suspected Al-Qaeda or Taliban militants in Afghanistan. Mr. Bakashi declined to identify the escapees from Pulisharki, but said a manhunt was underway to recapture them. He accused the prisoner guards of being involved in the prisoner's breakout plot.
A federal trial is underway in Wichita on a lawsuit challenging the Kansas law for reporting sexual activity by minors. At issue is State Attorney General Phil Klein's opinion that medical professionals, social workers, and others must notify authorities whenever they find out about underage sex of any kind. Klein's predecessor had interpreted it to allow discretion by professionals in reporting only cases that might involve abuse. The Center for Reproductive Rights contends that mandatory reporting discourages adolescents from seeking counseling or medical treatment and intrudes on their privacy. Jonathan Klein, a University of Rochester professor who researches adolescent health care, testified today about several studies. He said that all show teens are less likely to discuss their sexual activity when they know it won't remain confidential.
Oh, hallelujah!
A University of Washington scientist is disputing the claim of scientists who say they found the smallest fish in the world in an Indonesian swamp. It was less than a third of an inch long. The UW researcher Ted Peisch says he has an angler fish less than a quarter inch long. He has been studying the fish for 35 years. They live in the deep ocean a mile down. The tiny males have an unusual relationship with the larger females. They attach themselves to the female and feed off nutrients in the female bloodstream. That's the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, January 31st, 2006. If you have any questions or comments about what you heard this evening, please call us at 503-231-8032 and leave a message on extension 203 or send an email to pmnews@kboo.org. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on translator K264AA, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM on translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for tonight's newscast is Jim Thompson, and the audio editor is Kate Welsh. Special thanks to reporter Ross Egan. Our engineer is Judy Feistel. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. I'm Doug Guidi.
And I'm Kate Welch. Stay tuned for Independent Native News, followed by Wings, a woman's perspective on the election of Evo Morales in Bolivia. And coming up tomorrow at 7 a.m., hear the KBOO Morning News. At 7:30, Per Fagerin hosts Locus Focus Talk Radio. At 9 on The Bike Show, the topic is, what's the TriMet squeeze? Do TriMet bus drivers having it out for cyclists, or are they just trying to do their best while driving a very large vehicle? The guest is Karen LeMay, bicycle coordinator for TriMet and a bus operator. And at 10 on People Rise Up, Andrew Geller continues, it is happening here, his year-long investigation of fascism in the U.S. government and society. This part will focus on powerful and continuing expressions of nationalism. It features author and lecturer Michael Parenti as guest. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! That's all right here on KBOO, your nonprofit, volunteer-powered, and listener-sponsored community radio station. Thanks for joining us.
Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, January 31st, 2006. I'm Nell Abrams, sitting in for Ada Bogado. Iran says its referral to the UN Security Council would mean the end of diplomacy. The World Social Forum wrapped up in Caracas this past weekend. We'll bring you some of the highlights. And we remember civil rights icon Coretta Scott King and playwright Wendy Wasserstein. But first, these news headlines.
I'm Shannon Young with the Free Speech Radio News headlines. Opening arguments began today in the Enron trial, with both sides staying on message. Lisa Cohen reports from Houston.
Federal prosecutors told jurors today the Enron trial is a case about lies and choices, not about accounting. Defense lawyers for former Enron executive Jeff Skilling argued the case is very much about accounting. Attorney Daniel Petrocelli said when Skilling left the company 4 months before its bankruptcy, Enron was in fine financial health. Petrocelli said Skilling will take the stand in his defense. Halfway through opening arguments, jurors were given notepads, and some seemed to take extensive notes. Outside the federal courthouse in downtown Houston, what's known as the Enron trial is stirring up discussion in a city where thousands of people lost their jobs when the company collapsed. And the court of public opinion is also in session. From KPFT in Houston, I'm Lisa Cohen for Free Speech Radio News.
The Environmental Protection Agency has agreed to let some factory farms escape fines for environmental pollution in exchange for data on the extent of their contamination. Factory farms are industrial-scale feeding operations designed to maximize overall dairy or meat output. These operations produce massive amounts of animal excrement, which can result in serious water and air contamination. Under the terms of the first of 20 compliance agreements signed yesterday, the EPA will settle liability for certain past violations at factory farms and will be able to develop new compliance standards, guidelines, and enforcement policies. Meanwhile, the Iowa State Legislature is considering a bill that could penalize a person for filing repeated complaints against factory farm operations. Under the proposed law, anyone who files three or more complaints within 2 years' time could be labeled a, quote, chronic complainant if investigations do not find evidence of legal violations. So-called chronic complainants could be forced to pay damages and investigation costs to the owner of the feeding operation and to the government. In other news, Israeli forces invaded a village near the West Bank city of Jenin today, killing two people in the first armed clash since the Palestinian elections. Manar Jabrin reports from the West Bank.
Israeli army special units backed by armored vehicles and Apache helicopters invaded the village of Arraba this afternoon, surrounding a local house where members of the Islamic Jihad movement were thought to be hiding. two Palestinians inside of the house and an Israeli soldier were killed in the subsequent shootout. 15 civilian bystanders and at least two soldiers were injured. Ambulance driver Yad Mutlaq describes what he witnessed today.
We have received information that at least one Israeli soldier has been killed and at least two or three were injured. In addition, two Palestinians have been killed. We are unable to enter the area because the army has closed it. There are at least 15 Palestinians injured by live ammunition and we are unable to locate or reach them.
Nidal Abu Saada, senior leader of Al-Quds Brigades, the armed wing of Islamic Jihad, was reportedly killed. This military operation is part of a larger sweep of arrests of 22 residents through the West Bank cities, who are said to be activists of Hamas, Fatah, Islamic Jihad, and Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. For FSRN, this is Munar Jibreen reporting from Palestine.
In Britain, a report published today reveals how failed asylum seekers with children are going underground to avoid deportation. This just as a high court challenge on the issue of access to public services for asylum seekers has failed. From London, Naomi Fowler has more.
Last year, the government introduced regulations that cut all state support from families whose attempts to seek asylum in Britain are rejected. The families then risk threats to take their children into care because they've become destitute. It was intended to persuade families to return to their countries. But today's report from organisations the Refugee Council and Refugee Action says in a pilot scheme they were monitoring, more than a quarter of such families went underground when their support was cut. That means they lose all contact with services, leaving them and their children highly vulnerable. The first High Court challenge to the rules allowing the cutting of all state support has just failed. A Congolese woman had argued that cutting off support breached the Children Act and the Human Rights Act, but the judge disagreed. 100,000 or more destitute people who've gone underground in Britain are being assisted by the Red Cross and Médecins Sans Frontières, normally associated with conflict zones and international crises. This is Naomi Fowler in London for Free Speech Radio News.
Authorities in drought-stricken Kenya today rejected an offer of emergency food rations from a New Zealand dog food manufacturer. The founder of Mighty Mix Dog Food told Kenya's Daily Nation newspaper that she had originally planned to send biscuits, but decided to send 42 tons of a powdered mix after learning of the magnitude of the country's food crisis. A spokesperson for Kenya's government told the Agence France-Presse, quote, telling us that you are giving us food for dogs and our culture is an insult of the highest order. Maybe she was trying to help, but I hope this offer is a result of naivete. The manufacturer has defended her offer by saying that the mixture is not dog food, but a modified recipe fit for human consumption. I'm Shannon Young for Free Speech Radio News.
Ben Bernanke was just confirmed as the Federal Reserve Chairman to replace Alan Greenspan. Greenspan served for nearly 20 years. And Samuel Alito is the newest member of the U.S. Supreme Court. It's a major win for President Bush as he prepares to give the annual State of the Union address this evening. Leanne Caldwell has more from Capitol Hill.
On this vote, the ayes are 58, the nays are 42. The President's nomination of Samuel A. Alito, Jr. of New Jersey to be an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States is confirmed.
Four senators crossed party lines. The Democrats voting to confirm Alito were Senators Robert Byrd of West Virginia, Kent Conrad of North Dakota, and Ben Nelson of Florida. The sole Republican to vote with the majority of Democrats was Lincoln Chafee of Rhode Island. Independent James Jeffords of Vermont opposed Alito. But anticipation remained high until the end, with both Alito support and opposition groups waiting outside the Senate chamber to congratulate their senators for either a fight well fought or a win well won. Deborah Ness is president of the National Partnership for Women and Families.
The overall vote is a very sad day for the American public. This is going to be a terrible vote for women's rights and civil rights and our right to privacy. But I really applaud the courage of the senators who stand up and voted on principle.
I think it's marvelous. The American people have won because the majority do want to judge Alito.
That was Rita Warren. She says she is a lobbyist for God. Following the vote, Republican senators gathered to say they stopped liberal groups from sabotaging the confirmation process. Republican Senator John Warner from Virginia.
My hope is that, as some have forecast, that perhaps the filibuster of judicial nominees is dead. This is a recent innovation when President Bush became president. It's something that had never happened before and should never happen again. And that all nominees of a president are entitled to an up or down vote.
But Republicans led a vote-stalling tactic that can be interpreted as a filibuster of Supreme Court nominee Abe Fortas in 1968. They defend that move, saying a majority of senators of both parties opposed his confirmation. Massachusetts Senators John Kerry and Ted Kennedy launched a push for a debate-stalling filibuster late last week. They hope to delay the confirmation vote at least until after the State of the Union address. President Bush's State of the Union is tonight, where he is expected to tout Alito's confirmation as a major win. He is also expected to touch on a range of both foreign and domestic issues. Themes will include defense of the national spying program in the name of safety and security, and the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. As for domestic issues, the president will speak about extending the tax cuts, health care reform, and new energy policies. The annual address acts as a yearly agenda for the party in charge of the White House. But newly elected Governor of Virginia, Tim Kaine, will give the Democratic response shortly after the president concludes. And the Congressional Progressive Caucus, a group of members of the House of Representatives, laid out their progressive agenda for the year. Democratic Congressperson Barbara Lee from California said they will focus on poverty.
He is the president. We asked him to submit to Congress his plan for eradicating poverty. The second calls on Congress for accountability and would require the Congressional Budget Office to report on the poverty impact of legislation, all legislation, pending before Congress. And the third one calls for establishing priorities that would roll back tax cuts for the wealthiest and pay for poverty alleviation strategies.
The State of the Union address will begin at 9 p.m. Eastern tonight. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
Early in the morning London time, Chinese and Russian representatives joined the United States, Britain, and France in calling on the United Nations nuclear watchdog to report Iran to the Security Council. There was rapid response. Iranian Vice President Aghazadeh said there is no legal justification for such a move and that it would be the end of diplomacy. Selena Masuda reports from Washington, D.C.
Russia and China, Iran's allies, agreed to a formal referral to the Security Council only if it would be scheduled to take place after the International Atomic Energy Agency's regular meeting on March the 6th. This would give Iran 1 month to comply with IAEA's concerns and give Russia an opportunity to work with Iran during their February the 8th meeting. However, on Tuesday, Iran responded to the five big powers, Germany and the European Union, with their own threat, saying that if they are referred to the Security Council, they will no longer cooperate with the UN and plan to stop allowing surprise UN inspections of its nuclear sites. Some Washington analysts, like Professor Raymond Tanter of the Iran Policy Committee, think the United States should practice what he calls coercive diplomacy in dealing with Iran, including supporting Iran's main opposition groups.
Empowering the Iranian people, not people in general, but through the pro-democracy opposition groups. But the only way you can do that is to take the main opposition groups off of the foreign terrorist organizations list. And I see a growing sentiment within the Bush administration for doing that very thing.
The Iran Policy Committee, a group that advocates for regime change in Iran, accuses Iran of constructing a top-secret tunnel as part of its nuclear weapons program. Alirez Jafarzadeh is part of the committee.
This is yet another indication that Iran is actually increasingly moving its nuclear weapons program underground, making it even more secretive, while they are promising transparency in their talks and negotiations. Clearly, there is a gap between the Iran regime's deeds and their words.
Iran continues to say that their nuclear program is being used for energy purposes. Critics of the referral say that it is discriminatory to expect Iran to comply with the 1970 Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty when countries like Britain, Russia, and the United States still maintain nuclear weapons. In his State of the Union address Tuesday night, President Bush is expected to mention U.S. concerns over Iran.
Selena Masuda, FSRN, in Washington, D.C.
Al Jazeera Today showed part of a videotape of American hostage Jill Carroll, a freelance reporter on assignment for the Christian Science Monitor, who was kidnapped in Baghdad earlier this month. Jazeera reported that Carroll made a plea for the release of female prisoners in U.S. and Iraqi custody. Violence continued in the country, with the U.S. military calling in an airstrike against what it says was a guerrilla position in a soccer stadium following clashes with fighters in the western city of Ramadi. There was also an attack on Iraqi police in Nasiriyah in the south, and a British soldier was killed by a roadside bomb in Misan province, also in the south. Against this backdrop, negotiations over who will be Iraq's next prime minister continue. Cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, whose militia fought foreign troops last summer before a ceasefire was declared, said Monday that he will not support any candidate that does not call for an American withdrawal. Salam Talib and David Enders filed this report.
With 29 members of parliament loyal to him, Sadr has a powerful swing vote within the United Iraqi Alliance, the country's largest political bloc, which is made up of Sadr followers and other conservative Shiite political parties. Sadr had in the past kept his distance from politics, but recently has been pursuing a largely political track and calling for a U.S. withdrawal. There were some Sadr loyalists in the last parliament, and they spearheaded the signing of an agreement across party lines that the matter of troop withdrawal be addressed by any Iraqi government. That is the stance the group is maintaining, says Sayyid Fadl al-Shara, a Sadr spokesman in Baghdad.
All the political powers agree to support a government that will call for the Americans to leave, or at least schedule the military withdrawal from Iraq. And we agree that rebuilding Iraq will be the main thing to support after that. And the Iraqis will know how to restore security to Iraq.
Sadr's militia has also clashed with that of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, a rival party within the UIA. Sadr is also the only Shiite leader who has made repeated overtures to members of the disenfranchised Sunni community. Al-Shara again.
We welcome anyone that has the experience to lead Iraq, to be in the government without any discrimination.
It is unclear when the UIA will take a final vote on the decision, but the candidates that have been mentioned so far are current Prime Minister Ibrahim al-Jafari of the Dawa Party, Adel Abdul Mahdi of the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, and Nadim Jabiri, Secretary General of the Fedila Party, most of whose support is in the southern city of Basra. Hussein Sharastani, a current speaker in the parliament and an independent member within the UIA, is also a possibility. Both Abdul Mahdi and Sharastani have worked closely in the past with Western intelligence agencies. I'm David Enders with Salam Talib, reporting for FSRN.
The second phase of the 6th annual World Social Forum finished up this weekend in Caracas, Venezuela. The World Social Forum began in 2001 in Porto Alegre, Brazil, as an alternative response to the World Economic Forum held in Davos, Switzerland. In 2005, the organizing committee decided to divide the forum into three polycentric sessions. One concluded in Bamako, Mali, earlier this week. Another is scheduled for March in Karachi, Pakistan. The third location, Caracas, Venezuela, was also the site of the first America's Social Forum in 2004. Free Speech Radio news correspondent Norm Stockwell brings us this portrait of the event.
The differences between Davos and Caracas are visible in many ways. Unlike the austere snow-covered setting of Davos, where the world's business elite huddle to plan the division of the world's resources, here in Caracas, thousands of activists with colorful clothes and banners gather in the warm sunlight to discuss ways of building another world, one in which justice and equality govern the distribution of resources and wealth. With nearly 70,000 people officially registered to take part in the forum's over 2,000 events this past week, Caracas was a very busy hub of activity. Participants from over 50 countries included several U.S. delegations. While somewhat chaotic, as participants tried to navigate the vast array of activities, the forum all in all was seen very fruitful by those who attended. Each year a debate ensues on whether the forum should take stands and make declarations, but many feel this would make the event something other than what its name implies, a forum for discussion. The real work of the World Social Forum actually begins after participants return home to share what they've learned with others. Jacobo Torres de Leon, international coordinator for the Venezuelan Bolivarian Workers Union and member of the organizing committee for this year's forum, said that one of the reasons Venezuela wanted to host this year's forum was to showcase the accomplishments and future plans of what they are calling the Bolivarian Revolution.
Any resulting form of solidarity with the Bolivarian Revolution that we have won is important to us. That the people of the world see clearly what is happening in our country, without intermediary and without hateful chains such as CNN twisting reality. With this accomplishment, we are opening our door to the world in 2006 in this great world social forum. And we are simply saying, listen to us and to all who have seen what is going on in Venezuela. It is absolutely not about whether another world is possible, but that another world is necessary. And together, we can achieve it.
The week of activities kicked off last Tuesday with a huge march and rally in downtown Caracas. The crowd was addressed from the stage by several U.S. anti-war activists, including women from Code Pink, Lucius Walker of Pastors for Peace, and Cindy Sheehan, mother of Casey Sheehan, who was killed in Iraq. Cindy Sheehan appeared at several events during the week and shared the stage with Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, who addressed forum participants on Wednesday evening in a huge sports arena.
Veo incluso que dentro de los Estados Unidos se ha comenzado de nuevo.
I also see that inside the U.S. a new movement has begun. Each day it becomes more conscious, more unified.
Bueno, habrá que recordar a Cindy.
We have to remember that Cindy began alone in Texas. Out at the ranch of Mr. Danger, she set up her ranch, the ranch of hope, of morality.
El rancho de la moral, de la esperanza. ¿Cómo se dice en inglés esperanza? Hope.
How do you say esperanza in English? Hope. Mrs. Hope.
Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the U.S. peace group Code Pink and the San Francisco-based international human rights organization Global Exchange, who brought a group of over 200 people to this year's forum, sees the lessons of Venezuela and the forum as a crucial inspiration to social movements in the United States.
People are so depressed in the United States, and there's such a feeling of lack of empowerment, and it's just amazing to come down here because you get this surge of energy, and you feel that the slogan of another world is possible is not just a slogan, it's a real thing.
The World Social Forum concluded Sunday evening. At the same moment, the Caracas Lions baseball team was winning their league championship to head on to the Caribbean Series. The final polycentric forum is scheduled to take place in Karachi, Pakistan, from March 24th through the 29th. Reporting from Caracas for Free Speech Radio News, this is Norman Stockwell.
A woman is raped every 30 minutes in India, a country of more than 1.1 billion people. Conviction rates are nearly nil in a feudal, patriarchal, underdeveloped society where factors like family pressure, illiteracy, the might of the police, and the unreasonably long process and application of law deny justice to women. In recent years, the abduction, rape, and murder case of 18-year-old Karanjit Kaur has become a symbol for thousands of villagers of the western Indian state of Punjab who turn out in huge numbers in protest. Now, the leaders who fought against the rapists have been sentenced to life in prison in other allegedly false cases. Scores of irate villagers are blocking roads, rails, and making pledges of protest against the feudal landlords, police, and judiciary. Our reporter, Vinod K. Jose, spent time with the protesting villagers and files this report from Punjab.
A movement has been building up around the case of Kiranjit Kaur. Kiranjit, an 18-year-old high school student, was abducted, raped, and murdered by two feudal landlords 8 years ago. The incident occurred when Kiranjit was coming back home after the country's 50th Independence Day celebrations in school. After the rape, she was buried in the sugarcane farm of the feudal lord. A massive uprising by villagers brought the culprits to the court of law. But now, the incident has taken another turn. Deshan Singh is the father of Kiranjit Kaur.
My daughter was raped and killed by landlords 8 years ago. Thousands of people came forward to protest. The leaders who mobilize people against the powerful landlords are in trouble now. They're booked under false cases and locked in prison for life, by the politically connected landlord family. This time people are agitating to release our leaders and punish the landlords.
The villages in this part of the country are still ruled by feudal landlords. They keep a private army as well. Police and administration dare not touch them. The landlords who murdered Kiranjit has 27 criminal cases against them, from land grabbing to rape and murder. Daljit Ami is a documentary filmmaker and a campaigner in the agitation.
Actually, the family which committed this crime, they were involved in such crimes of land grabbing, murders, rapes and other things. And they have their terror in the region. And they were politically well connected. They were connected with almost all the mainstream political parties. And they had their say in the administration, in the police.
But an alliance of teachers, farmers and workers decided to fight the Kiranjit's rapists. Prem Kumar, a teacher in his school, Narayan Ted, an employee in the electricity department, and Manjit Singh, a farmers' union leader, organized thousands of villagers against patriarchy and feudalism. But now, these three leaders are booked under a murder case and lodged in jail on life imprisonment. The thousands of villagers who still continue their protest believe the agitation leaders are booked on false charges by the powerful feudal landlords to break the movement. But the agitation is gaining more momentum. Villagers are coming in big numbers, blocking roads, rails, and taking pledge in protest against the feudal landlords and their private army. Recent in the protest was a tractor rally organized by the farmers.
Feudal lords and police cannot succeed. We want our leaders out. We will fight and we will win.
That was a leader speaking at the rally. Lieutenant Colonel Jagdish Singh Brar was an Indian Army officer. He is also taking part in the agitation.
When we were in the army, we were told that the security of your nation was the prime concern. But if women in your country are not safe, how safe can the country be? 50% of the population lives under exploitation. Cases of abduction, rape, and murder are increasing day by day.
The girls are asking where the rule of law is and would it be ever safe for them. From the villages of Western Indian state of Punjab in India, this is Vinod K. Jose for Free Speech Radio News.
Today we note the passing of two American women who devoted their lives to change. Award-winning playwright and arts activist Wendy Wasserstein died yesterday following a battle with lymphoma. She was 55. Wasserstein's best-known plays, written from a feminist perspective with a wry sense of humor, include The Heidi Chronicles, The Sisters Rosenzweig, and An American Daughter. And early this morning, civil rights leader Coretta Scott King died at the age of 78. She suffered a major stroke and heart attack in August and had been in decline ever since. The widow of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was a civil rights activist long before her marriage. After her husband was killed, Mrs. King emerged and remained at the forefront of the fight for equality for all Americans. A staunch pacifist, she influenced Dr. King's controversial decision in 1967 to speak out against the Vietnam War. The following is an excerpt of Mrs. King's remarks at the People's March on Washington in 1971.
Fear and hate pervades our society. This war is clearly an enemy of poor and black people. The war is an enemy to the American people. The war is an enemy of the national welfare, an enemy of a national medical plan that rids this country of infant mortality. Quality progressive education dies at the expense of the invasion of Laos and Cambodia. Subsidies for Lockheed aircraft, but crumbs for the empty stomachs of the hundreds of thousands of starving children. For several months now, the American people have collected signatures to the joint peace treaty between people of the United States and the people of Vietnam. Tens of millions of Americans oppose the war in Vietnam. Why can't we, the people of the United States and the people of Southeast Asia, make the peace? The 44,000 young men who have died there were our sons and brothers. The untold number that have been murdered and napalmed are our sons and brothers. So my quest is that the people make the peace. Let us declare that the war is over. And let us declare that the war on hunger and poverty and repression are in force.
After her husband's murder, Mrs. King fought for more than a decade to establish a federal holiday on his birthday. She also raised millions of dollars to establish the Martin Luther King Jr. Center for Nonviolent Change, an Atlanta complex that houses her husband's tomb, archives, and exhibits. She served as its president for 2 decades. Thanks to the Pacifica Radio Archives for providing the voice of the late Coretta Scott King. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. Sitting in for Ada Bogado, I'm Nell Abram at WMNF Community Radio in Tampa.
This is Independent Native News for Tuesday, the 31st of January, 2006. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock. In South Dakota, a legislative committee killed a measure Monday morning that would have funneled state dollars to tribal colleges. South Dakota Public Broadcasting's Johanna Saylor reports.
President of the Oglala Tribal College on Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, Tom Shortbull, says tribal colleges need more money to operate.
You know, when there are people that are suffering, we go and help them. And when you have a people in this state who have the highest unemployment rate, have the lowest per capita income, we should be out there supporting the work of a tribal college that is doing good, not only for Indian people, but for non-Indian people in the state.
Shortbull says tribal colleges receive federal aid for Native American students, but not for non-tribal members. Shortbull says the state should help pay for the non-Native students to the tune of $500,000. But Republican Senator Lee Schoenbeck from Watertown says it's not fair to give tribal colleges state dollars, but not all private institutions.
There are lots of institutions that do good work, and just because they do good work, we don't fund them out of the state budget. In fact, there are far more institutions in our state doing good work not funded by the state budget than there are those that are funded by the state budget.
The funding measure died 6-3. I'm Johanna Saylor in Pierce, South Dakota.
In an attempt to battle high fuel prices in rural Alaska, one tribal organization is taking matters into its own hands. In Dillingham, in the Bristol Bay region, the Turuyong Tribal Council gave the go-ahead to look at creating a bulk fuel group for those interested in being part of a fuel purchasing cooperative, according to Tribal Administrator Dorothy Larson.
So we're hoping that by having the ability to pull together groups of people to commit to certain amounts of fuel, by adding it together, we could save money in the purchase per gallon cost by having more ability to buy more fuel up front.
Turuyong is in the early stages of exploring the creation of a co-op. Larson says it is not necessary to be a tribal member to join. She says there are still a lot of kinks to work out. For example, the co-op members would have to guarantee to pay for their whole order up front.
That's where I see kind of a problem. Instead of buying 100 gallons every 3 to 4 weeks of heating fuel in this cooperative, you know, we may need to purchase the fuel in bulk up front so that it would be a bigger upfront cost instead of spreading it out over 6 months and doing it every 3 weeks or so.
Fuel prices in rural Alaska are some of the highest in the country, and a recent cold spell is making it even more difficult for residents to make ends meet. Meanwhile, the Sac and Fox Tribe of the Mississippi of Iowa, also known as the Meskwaki, has qualified for a federal loan program for housing in 6 Iowa counties. Pat Blank reports.
The initiative is offered through the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, or HUD. The program allows Native Americans to apply for loans guaranteed by the federal agency. Native Americans living in Tama County, where the tribe settlement is located, and those in five surrounding counties are eligible. The program was created in 1992 to address the lack of mortgage lending for Native Americans, thus giving families the opportunity to buy a home. The money can also be used to rehabilitate existing houses, build a home, or refinance existing loans. The loans carry no income requirements as long as applicants have money to make payments. Loan limits depend on family size. For example, a family of three may be eligible for as much as $310,000. The Meskwaki are the only federally recognized tribe in the state of Iowa, with more than 1,200 members. Reporting from Cedar Falls, Iowa, this is Pat Blank.
This is Independent Native News. I'm Bonnie Sue Hitchcock.
Supported by Ridolfi Incorporated, engineers and scientists concerned with the earth, RIDOLFI.com. And by Amerind Risk Management Corporation, a multi-regional, multi-tribal federal corporation serving Indian Country. Amerind-Corp.org.
Independent Native News is a production of KUAC at the University of Alaska Fairbanks.